Radio Pulpit, 657 AM, your daily companion.
Tune in, grow in faith.
And a very good afternoon once again. If you've just locked in, this is of course that time where we delve into health matters. Now, autism is being diagnosed more frequently across the world, yet many parents still struggle to recognize the early signs or know where to turn to for support. What is autism? How does it present itself? And what does early intervention actually look like in real life? That's what we're chatting about today. And with me, she is part of the Wellbeings Africa Medical Advisory Team, is Dr. Kutso, who is a specialist pediatrician. Listen, for a second there when I said Dr. Kutso, I had to remember I'm closer, so I mustn't be rough on that. So, Dr. Kutso, good afternoon and welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be back with you guys again.
Oh, man, I must say, this topic we're about to discuss right now is one very close to my heart. And I think particularly because I've had literally a close colleague or friend back in, you know, the day. Her child was diagnosed with autism. But even before that, she was struggling to make sure that he got all the attention because as a mother, she just could not accept. Though the teachers could see some signs, she was just struggling to accept. And so whenever I hear about it, I'm like, oh my goodness, I wish we could do better. And I know it's not out of intention. It's not because moms generally want to punish their children, but it is difficult because no mom wants to believe that something is, quote, wrong, unquote, you know, with their child. And so it's a very sensitive one.
Absolutely. You know, I think autism is one of those words that every single parent now has heard of, you know. So it's a bit of a buzz, but it's also very scary for a lot of people. So like with you, a lot of people will tell you, like, my cousin's friend or my sister's child or someone close to them has been diagnosed. And just like from an empathy, from a sideline, just viewing it point of view, everyone has just seen how much these parents and these children go through, right?
Yeah.
Such an important conversation to have. And I'm really glad that we're having this conversation today.
I think let's start right here, Dr. Kutso. This is going to help a lot of us. What exactly is autism and how should parents understand it beyond the clinical definition?
So I think that's such an important place to start, truly, especially this month, because, you know, we celebrate or commemorate World Autism Awareness Month, and we celebrated the day on the 2nd of April. Mm-hmm. And basically, autism is what we call a neurodevelopmental condition, right? Which means that the brain develops and processes information differently from an early age, right? Mm-hmm. We usually see this show up in three main areas. So it's how the child communicates, right? So whether they speak or don't speak, we know they can be verbal or nonverbal.
Yeah.
How they connect socially. So that's, you know, talking to other children we've mentioned, but also laughing, playing, just that social interaction aspect. And also how they behave or interact with the environment. So it's how they behave and interact with people, but also how they behave and interact with the environment, right? So, for example, a child might struggle to use words or gestures, might not engage so easily, you know, in that back and forth communication that we so take for granted, like we're doing right now, you know. Or they may prefer very structured routines. So they don't do well with like imagination and thinking outside of the box. They actually really prefer things to be aligned and perfect, right? But ultimately, the one thing I always emphasize to parents that it's not something that is caused. You know, it's not something that you caused by, there's nothing you could have done to give your child or not give your child autism, right? And it's also not really something to be fixed. I think it's something to be understood, you know, particularly that it's really a different way that they experience and respond to the world. Mm. And sometimes, like we say, that we need to go into their world and kind of acknowledge that it's different to our world. So we don't necessarily need them to adapt. And by them, I mean, you know, children that are affected by autism, that they don't necessarily need to adapt to our world, but we need to find a way to adapt to theirs. And I think when you look at it like that, then it becomes less of a problem to be fixed, but rather a condition to be understood.
Hmm. Listen, Dr. Kuto, with regard to autism, we often hear terms like spectrum. What does that mean in a child's day-to-day behavior?
So we know in the full word, the autism spectrum disorder, that it's really a big part of what autism is, right?
Mm.
And say autism, we're really just acknowledging how different and varied autism can look from child to child, you know? So there isn't one single way that a child with autism is going to present, or that all children with autism are going to present, right? So again, like I said earlier, you can have a child who's completely nonverbal and needs a lot of support with like everyday things, right? And a child who's very verbal, academically very strong, but struggles with social cues and friendships and like sensory overload and things like that. So it's not so much, because when you think spectrum, you think like mild, moderate, severe, or like grade one, grade two, grade three, right? It's not so much that, it's more just a difference in strengths, in challenges, and in what they need in terms of support.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, tell me, what are the earliest signs of autism that parents should be looking out for in babies and toddlers even?
Yeah. So, you know, it's one of those things that in retrospect, you can kind of be like, okay, well, I suppose the signs were there. And you often hear parents, and this is the power of instinct, right? You often hear parents say, I knew from quite an early age, right? In terms of the diagnosis, in terms of, you know, actually being able to make a diagnosis, that usually comes early on. You know, that's when, and typically the first thing the older kids are going to present with is a speech delay or a concern around speech, right? Because that's the obvious thing. Like, my child must be speaking. My child is not speaking. There's obviously something wrong. But a lot of mothers will tell you retrospectively that, you know, I knew kind of that there was something wrong. And in babies and toddlers, we now know that some of those early signs are limited eye contact, right? So remember, from about between 6 weeks and 4 months, we really expect a child to fix and follow and be able to kind of make eye contact with you and look around the room, etc. But some of the early signs really do include limited eye contact. As they get older, we find these kids don't consistently respond to their name. Delayed speech, like I mentioned. And then one of the most important signs that parents must never miss is regression or losing skills or speech skills, particularly that they had before. And you'll often hear a mother say, you know, my child was speaking and then they stopped, you know, suddenly he's not speaking anymore. And already that's a big, big red flag for us, right? The other early signs is a child that doesn't point to show interest. So around 18 months, when children are kind of in that learning words but don't really know the words to everything, they'll often like drag your hand and point to the things that they want. Or point like, look over there, for example. They don't do that, you know. So they don't point to show interest in things. They don't wave. They don't engage socially in the expected way. And quite early on, we know how social children are. We see that these kids tend to prefer to play alone rather than show interest in social activities like playing with other children, right? Some kids will also show like very repetitive behaviors that are almost like not in keeping with what you'd expect of a child their age, you know, like lining up their toys in a very specific way, flapping their hands, for example. We see a lot of them do that, covering their ears, or becoming extremely distressed with small changes in routine. Now, you know, because you have small kids, that they don't like a change in routine. Most kids are gonna lose their minds a little bit if something is done a little bit differently. But it shouldn't be this extreme distress. I mean, if bath time is earlier, they should be okay with bath time being a little bit earlier once they settle into the bath. But the moment you give them their food in a different colored dish, or, you know, change the routine of how things are done, be it story time, bath time, story time, sleep, for example. And the moment you change their routine, they lose their minds. And that's one of the signs really that we should be aware of. But, you know, whenever we talk about signs of autism, it's very important to say that one sign on its own does not mean autism, right? And that's a tricky thing because of where we are in terms of social awareness, right? Especially kind of on every newsfeed, on everything, right? Yeah. So it's very easy to almost overread the signs of your child and think, oh my gosh, you know, he didn't look at me or he didn't respond to his name. And that one single sign does not mean autism over one period of time. It's when you really start seeing consistent patterns over time that it's really worth getting an assessment. And of course, trusting your instinct. But I think currently there's almost an over-awareness around it, which is great, but it also means that more parents, I'm seeing in my practice, so many more parents are worried about, you know, the small subtle signs, just because it's what they've heard on social media or heard being talked about on the street. So that's the thing.
I like what you just said there, Dr. Kuto. I'm just trying to remember the exact word you used, but the fact that we overemphasize on these things, and I think from just one little sign, and I think it happens a lot as well to mental health issues, as much as we need to take them seriously, but I think we take it to the extreme end sometimes. And I worry that we're going to end up having ourselves or our children misdiagnosed, because at the first sign, we run and I'm saying misdiagnosed because we do the diagnosis ourselves oftentimes.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, now it's become easy, right? Because everywhere you go on social media, there's someone saying, these are the signs, a list. If you want, you can download. I saw the other day there was an adult autism diagnostic tool that you could just like click on.
Sure.
And it would say, if this letter looks different, you might have autism or something.
Like sure.
Oh, hectic. And I think that's the thing, is that it's almost become, I want to say, easier to diagnose, but not really, because it's almost like anyone can just, you know, download an app or click on a link and there you have a diagnosis. And I really want to warn parents about that. I'm a firm believer on be the parent, let someone else deal with that stuff. Who's trained to do it, who's going to hold your hand through it so that you're not doing everything, because we can't do everything.
Sure. Yeah. Now, tell me, Dr. Kutsu, are there differences in how autism presents itself in boys versus girls?
Yes. And it's definitely something we're becoming much more aware of. I think most children that I've seen that are diagnosed with autism are boys, right? So it's definitely diagnosed more frequently in boys, but it's because in girls it's often under-recognized. Right. Mm. And I think it's just a thing that females do. where they tend to mask their difficulties, you know, so they're not going to just like, it's a party, it's my world, I just do whatever, right? They tend to mask their difficulties quite a lot. So they may copy social behaviors that they're seeing other children do. They may maintain eye contact or just like look like they're shy or quiet, you know. So they tend to mask their behaviors with more behaviors of withdrawal. And that in itself means that these challenges are missed, right? Mm. Or picked up much later. And even then it's in association with something else. So maybe she's very distractible or she seems to zone out, but it's almost like the symptoms or the signs of autism in girls tend to be a lot quieter. You know what I mean?
Mm.
So generally, I think with awareness, that's the awareness that's improving, we're probably going to find we're picking up a lot more girls. But generally in girls, we tend to struggle a bit to make the diagnosis because they almost seem to adapt to the environment and mask their symptoms a lot more.
Hmm. Girl power. Sorry to say that, but hey, we seem to have things together at some point in time. Okay, that joke is a bit distasteful, but I thoroughly understand. I think generally, I'm even thinking about a conversation I had with a friend of mine a while ago, but it was totally unrelated to autism. But with the fact that even with feelings, as much as we emotional people, I think we burst more because for the longest time, we try to hide because we always want to look like we've got it, you know, in control. And then you burst because you really don't, baby girl. You don't.
Don't, yeah. And the thing is, like, little girls, you'll see, they learn quite early that they're ladies, you know. again, very unrelated, but sit like a lady, sit there, do
True.
That. They've behaved very different. And I think it's unfortunate, because when it comes to things like autism, even ADHD, really, and a lot of neurodevelopmental conditions, we do find that little girls are diagnosed later just because they, quote unquote, behave better and they're more subject. And they're quieter and more withdrawn. So you tend to think, oh, she's just shy and quiet, you know.
Yeah.
Which really is that we need to pay attention to.
Speaking of diagnosis, Dr. Kutso, how is autism diagnosed in children and who is involved in that process?
So there isn't a single test. I really need to start by saying that there is no single test. Mm. There's no scan. There is no blood test that's going to tell you that your child has autism, right? It is based on a very detailed developmental history, very careful observation of how your child communicates, how your child interacts socially. And also, and what's very important, is the history from the caregivers, the input from the caregivers, sometimes even the teachers, because we find now with the awareness that a lot of teachers are picking something up, right? So sometimes it's not, I'm worried that this child may have autism. But if you think about how many children the average teacher is exposed to, it kind of makes it quite important to listen to what the teacher says, you know, just by virtue of the experience of numbers, you know, the experience of having seen a whole bunch of kids, they are going to notice if there's a child that is doing things perhaps a little bit differently to, you know, what everyone else in the class is doing. Essentially it's ideally the diagnosis needs to be made by a multidisciplinary team involving a pediatrician, most often a neurodevelopmental pediatrician, but general pediatricians can do it as well, a speech therapist, an occupational therapist, and then sometimes a psychologist as well. But it's really a multidisciplinary team working together to make the diagnosis based on a very detailed history, watching the child play, and really getting collateral from the family, the people that spend time with the child, and the teachers.
Listen, if I didn't believe I was what you call layman to medicine, today I do, because I really just thought the only specialty to children would be you are a pediatrician and that's it. Now you just spoke of a neuropediatrician. I'm like, oh, there's another degree to this. I did not know that. So I've learned a thing today.
There is. I mean, in our setting, in the South African setting, access to subspecialists or like a neurodevelopmental pediatrician can be extremely limited. Mm. So, I mean, I think having a doctor that you trust, especially if you have a child, if you're not seeing a pediatrician, at least see a GP or a doctor that is well-versed in children and has spent enough time in children, or even better, has a special interest in children. Because really, someone who is trained in children is going to play quite a central role in helping you identify these concerns early and also guiding you towards the right support, you know, because we kind of know each other. We know, you know, who the correct OTs are and who the correct speech therapists are, for example. So really just aligning yourself with those spaces, even before the diagnosis of autism is made, I think is quite important for parents.
Okay. What does early intervention involve, Dr. Kutso?
So early intervention is like my favorite thing for like everything, always, because we know that the brain of a child is so incredibly adaptable, right? Mm. So early intervention, and it's not just for autism, it's for any condition, really, child's brain or nervous system development is concerned. It simply means identifying and supporting a child as early as possible. Basically, it's never too early, right? Mm. And we see this every day where it makes such a real difference in terms of how your child is going to be in the long term, how they're going to perform at school, how much they're able to achieve in terms of speech and what they learn and how they integrate sensorily with the environment, you know. And a lot of the support may include just like speech therapy, just to help communicate, occupational therapy, again, for sensory processing, and just daily skills. And importantly, and it's what a lot of people forget, is support for parents on how to, number one, accept the diagnosis. Like you mentioned earlier, there's often a problem with denial, you know, but also how to engage their child at home. I mean, we've all seen an overwhelmed parent in the mall with a child that's throwing themselves on the ground and losing right? So it's really quite important. And you can imagine the difficulty that this poses on the family dynamic where you have a child with very special needs, you know. So it really just is helping the family, supporting the family through, number one, accepting the diagnosis, number two, adapting as a family to the diagnosis, and number three, supporting the child to, you know, really reach their potential. And really just, I mean, just to say that a lot of the therapy happens at home. You know, the most powerful therapy really happens in the everyday moments, how you speak to your child, how you play with them, how you respond to them. And this is not just for children with autism. It's really for every parent.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what kind of therapies or support systems have the strongest evidence for improving outcomes?
So, of course, we want to focus on what is evidence-based, right? And I love that you said evidence, because again, with something like autism that's so poorly misunderstood, there's lots of room for gimmicks and, I want to say, fly-by-night therapies, and it sounds terrible. It really is that. The strongest evidence is for early intervention and therapy. So speech and language therapy, occupational therapy, and what we call structural behavioral interventions that just help them adapt, you know, and build their communication skills and adapt to the things that they may not necessarily like. You know, in our context, and I'm going to go back to it, what's very important is just for parents to be really cautious about expensive treatments and miracle cures and milks and, you know, medications, quote unquote, that are really not supported by good evidence, right? And I think, you know, I think families can be so vulnerable when they're desperate for answers and when they are for a cure for something that we are really saying there is no cure. If there was a cure, we would be running to get it, right? So there is no cure. But really part of the role is really to guide. And I think this is why like shows and conversations like this are so important, is I think that we really need to work guiding patients and parents towards interventions that are actually going to help their child and that are actually sustainable. Because sure, a lot of these things are so expensive, and out of the desperation of not understanding and being so desperate for answers, parents are sitting ducks for scams, and they really will try everything. And I get it, because I would want to try everything if it was me, you know?
Listen, Dr. Kutso, I've heard a lot, and I think in conversations, and I've seen it happen, you know, to a couple of my friends' children, where one moment a child is diagnosed with autism and the next you hear they're going back to school. And I always wonder to myself, at what point does that happen? Like, does it get better? Do they get used to a system? I really, really wonder to myself. So tell me, can children with autism attend mainstream schools, and what determines that exactly?
Remember at the beginning we said it's a spectrum, right? Meaning that no two children will have exactly the same presentation and exactly the same strengths and challenges, right? So I mean, many children with autism can actually attend mainstream schools, but it really depends on the individual child, right? We look at things like their ability to communicate. Obviously, you need that in school. Behavioral regulation. Obviously, you need a sense of at least being able to integrate and be adaptable to the environment, that not everything is so stimulating, because then they just won't manage, right? Okay. And also whether the school can provide appropriate support. It's really great now how a lot of schools have OTs at school and speech therapists at school, because that adds to the support that they're able to give to the individual learner, right? There are children that do really well in mainstream schools, with some accommodations. You know, they might need like a weighted pillow or a weighted blanket while they sit in class. But some kids do benefit more from specialized environments where teaching is adapted to their needs, you know, smaller classes, getting OT during the school day, having someone that's there to give them medication if they need medication. So it's really not about one sort of schooling system being better than the other. It's whatever environment allows each individual child to function well and thrive in that environment. And I guess that looks different for every child.
Okay. And what are the most common myths about autism that you'd like to correct today or debunk?
Okay. So, I mean, there's a few, obviously, with something as misunderstood, as almost cryptic as autism, it only makes sense that people are going to fill in the gaps with words, you know, with stuff. One is that vaccines cause autism, right? And this has been disproven time and time and time again, but I still meet people that are worried that certain vaccines are going to cause their child to be autistic. Another is that children with autism don't feel, you know, don't feel emotions, you know. I think it's more an expression thing, you know, that they express their feelings very deeply. Another is that autism can be caused by, you know, something around how the child was parented or how the pregnancy was, or, you know, there's a lot of concerns about things like that. And it's not. We know that autism is not caused by anything you did. It's not caused by parenting. It's not caused by being strict or being not strict. And I think, you know, a lot of the myths just always show us how parents often carry this unnecessary guilt, you know, and I think the myths are something we need to move away from because no one chooses it for themselves.
Exactly. Just a quick one. Also, I need to find clarity on this. We speak of the different types of schools. We just spoke about it now. You know, mainstream school and obviously school for special needs. Does this mean that if my child has gone, let's say, to, because I've seen a lot of parents with kids with special needs actually send them to your homeschool facilities because, like you said, you know, they must try and find facilities that may not necessarily be stimulating for them. Does this mean that my child can still be competent in that environment, or is it a case of you're a special needs child and that's it? And because I've also seen a lot of special needs or autism, children with autism, actually go to varsity and graduate.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, it boils down to the individual child, you know, and again, it boils down to early intervention. So I think the earlier we're intervening, the more we're able to see what our child's potential is, you know. Again, I don't think that this is a journey that any parent needs to be walking on their own and kind of decisions you should be making on your own. I think it should be decisions that are made as part of a multidisciplinary team. Like, look, this is what your child needs or doesn't need, and this is what we are able to do. So many kids are able to thrive in normal, quote unquote, mainstream schools, and a lot of kids are not able to. And the situation can change. So just because you are in a mainstream school doesn't mean you can't move to a special needs school later. And just because you're in a special needs school doesn't mean you can't go to a normal university. And again, this is where intervention and support modalities really, really make the difference.
Listen, Dr. Kutsu, you and I could go on and on and on because this conversation would never just end. But listen, just a plug us here. You're around Gauteng, right?
Yeah, I'm in Johannesburg,
You are
yes.
in Johannesburg. That's the other side of where we are. But listen, if I'm listening right now and I'm like, oh, I'm loving this, doctor. I just had a thought right now, but I'll chat to you about it. But I'm really loving and I would love to bring my little one through. Where can we find you?
Okay, so I'm at Dr. S.K. Matseke Memorial Hospital in Soweto, which is again on the other side of where you are. But what I do a lot is a lot of parental education, right? So I actually have a podcast where we recently did quite a very in-depth discussion with a neurodevelopmental pediatrician around autism, and I left so empowered and I learned so much, and I think it might help a lot of parents just to tune into to that show. But pretty much, I'm pretty much everywhere. I'm Dr. K for Kids on Instagram, Dr. K for Kids on TikTok. And Tiny Matters with Dr. K is my YouTube channel.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Kutso, and have a lovely day further. God bless.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me again. We'll talk soon.
Let Christ inspire your day. Do you need prayer? Radio Pulpit, in collaboration with Need Pray, is ready to stand in prayer with you. Contact us today with your prayer request at 012-334-1222 or WhatsApp us on 067-429-7564. You can also visit us on radiopulpit.co.za for your online prayer request. We will faithfully pray with you.
You can now listen to Radio Pulpit from Silbay to Sandfontein to Sydney. Listen live to Radio Pulpit on radiopulpit.co.za, DStv 882 and OpenView 607. Also follow us on our social media, download our app and listen to our podcasts wherever you are. Radio Pulpit, your Christian alternative at your fingertips.
Radio Pulpit 657 AM, bringing the Word of God to you.
You and 657 AM and life, a winning team on the road to eternity.